Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt. I'm Dan Dixon.
My name is Joseph Herp. That was an interesting rhythm to that intro. You, like, quickened when you said your own name.
Yeah.
If someone's favourite part of the Brad Pitt Cast is, like, the opening 20 seconds, do you want to drink some of your next bidet?
Yeah, you can absolutely. Drink it. Thank you, Joseph.
It's very clanky with the ice cube.
It is a bit, but it's Foley.
Have we ever talked about Nexpa on the podcast?
Do they sponsor us?
I mean, I wish. When I gave up drinking, I switched almost entirely to drinking this stuff called Nexpa, which is like a sugar-free soda, which I think is probably reasonably good for you, but I just think it's bad for your teeth.
Yeah.
But Nexpa was kind of, I feel like, a formative thing in our friendship a little bit.
Mm.
In that when you came over for a period there, it would always be like, can I get you a Nexpa? Wasn't there a day where we watched a movie and we drank like 3 or 4 Nexpas?
Definitely. It might have been, I think it was one of the early pits.
Yeah, when we were recording, maybe watching for an episode.
Yeah,
we just drank a lot of Nexpa. It's good.
Probably affected. I hope it wasn't Thelma and Louise. Maybe that's the reason that episode's insane.
I basically, just before we started recording, said, Dan, I had a good time watching the film The Mexican. And you didn't have a good time. I mean,
Not really.
You said, do I even like movies?
I mean, I wonder. Yeah, I was thinking about that during. I've been thinking about that drill tweet you quoted a while back.
Mm.
About all movies are basically that they're all like 3 stars or whatever. I think I do kind of believe that. And I was reflecting on why I think that is.
I think you're even more negative, though. I think you think all films are like 2.2.
Maybe. But I don't really watch movies alone anymore at home. I'll really enjoy seeing a movie solo at the cinema. That's a real pleasure.
That's the experience of going out.
I wonder. So I think a lot of films for me, the pleasure is that I'm watching them with someone.
You didn't like a bunch of the movies that we watched together for this podcast.
Well, yeah, although that's different, right? Because I've watched a bunch of movies. I've liked a bunch of movies we've watched together, though, right?
True.
These were early Pitt films where, like, basically take a random selection of American films from the early 90s and late 80s.
You think if you would have watched Sweet Smell of Success by yourself, you wouldn't have liked it so much?
No, sorry. I would have liked that film because it's a masterpiece. I think I will like some films, but only 5-star films, basically.
Really? And everything is 2.5 stars
or
5 stars?
Yeah, I think it's... And I wonder if it's something to do. I mean, I'm sure I'm upsetting a lot of people right now, and this is a very unconsidered
I don't know
position.
How many Mexican stands there are out there.
No, I just mean in general. I mean, yeah.
Do you think this podcast has taught you that you like movies less than you thought?
I think so, maybe.
But you enjoy the process of picking them
Definitely.
Apart,
Definitely.
Right?
I enjoy talking about them. Yeah. I enjoy talking about anything, but especially art. And I enjoy talking about film. I enjoy watching something with a view to... Picking it apart.
I think there's something...
Also, we haven't watched that...
Sorry.
Leave that in, Joe.
Is it too loud?
I don't know. Probably blew out the microphone.
I have really bad hay fever. At the moment, I don't know what's going on. It's winter. Maybe if that is too loud, I'll just put a beep in there. So, viewers, you may have just heard like a random beep. That was me sneezing.
Yeah,
if it blew out the mic.
We need a sneeze button. The sneeze threw me off.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. We haven't watched many movies that many people consider great as well, though, right?
That's true.
I align pretty... I don't align that much with critical consensus, but I don't have a radically subversive view of cinema quality. I'm not someone who has, like you have a very specific idea of what good cinema is that is contrary to a lot of critics. I just don't think I do.
Mm. I think you do.
Oh, that's interesting. Maybe. I hope so. I'd like that.
There's a real through line between the films that matter to you.
The films that matter the most to me personally, I think that's absolutely true.
As specific as mine.
Okay, maybe.
I think so.
Well, you tend to know... I would put credence in that because you tend... The films you have recommended me as saying this is a Dan film, you're almost always right. I can't think of one that you've missed, really.
An interesting, and we'll get into specific discussions of the film at hand, which is 2001's
The Mexican.
Gore Verbinski directed The Mexican. We have to have a brief talk about that title and problematic things about this film that we will have to front load any discussion with.
Oh my gosh.
So we'll get there. I think an interesting thing is, I think what will inevitably happen over the course of this episode, and we'll check back in at the end to see if we're right. I have problems with this film. I have quite a lot of problems with this film. Ultimately, I enjoy this film.
Yeah.
And I enjoy the experience of watching it. Because the problems occur, and they don't necessarily make me angry. And there's still stuff that I'm ready to accept after a string of quite serious problems with the film. I think you were the opposite way. Like, the things that don't work really stick with you. And they make you unable to say, yeah, I enjoyed this film. Whereas I can say, like, Mexican's full of tons of, yeah, problems. Famously, obviously full of problems. It's a fucking 2-hour long movie for no reason. It should be at best like a tight 80 minutes. Like, that's just one of many problems, including like quite serious issues of political correctness that, as I say, yeah, we'll get to. I still think that this is an interesting film.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I think I had that exact thought while watching this, was there's some things about this film I really like.
But yeah,
exactly.
I'm the opposite.
But the problems with it make it an object that I come down on the negative side. Thumbs down. Despite liking a bunch of things about it.
Yeah, I'm the opposite. I say there is stuff that is a problem in this film, but
it's important to remember that, I think, because I think often we do actually have quite a lot of overlap just when we come to verdicts, where we have verdict clashes, you know?
I think that's true. Should we do a little bit of the Mexican context?
Please. And then tell me about Gore Verbinski.
Do you know anything about Gore Verbinski?
Did he direct Mousetrap?
He did.
I hated that film. I saw that as a child in the cinema and absolutely despised it.
Why did you hate Mousetrap?
It made me uncomfortable. It seemed mean and cruel.
It is mean.
As a child, I hated meanness. To this day, I've always been a
really good film. Well, I really like Mousetrap. Maybe that should be a bonus episode.
Mm.
Well, Verbinski is fascinating, right? Because do you know what his very first film is?
I do not.
Can you guess?
No.
We just mentioned it.
Oh, Mousetrap. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
1997's Mousetrap.
Weird. Doesn't that have... Who's in that again?
Nathan Lane. Yeah, and...
And a thinner person, right? It's like Lee that Evans. Classic kind of... Yeah,
yeah, Laurel and Hardy.
Laurel and Hardy dynamic. I just remember the Laurel and Hardy kind of silhouettes.
Do you know how much Mousetrap made at the box office?
Well, I saw it, so I assume a fair amount. Especially if all these people are signing up to his next film.
$40 million was the budget.
Okay, that's a lot for Mousetrap.
It made $122 million
crazy.
In 1997 money. Smash hit.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think that if they made Mousetrap now, and it had that box office performance, the studio would be like, Mousetrap 2, Mousetrap Harder is like in the Mousetrap Reverse. Yeah.
Mousetrap Land.
It would be happening immediately.
Yeah.
His second film is The Mexican in 2001. The first thing to say about The Mexican contextually is huge flop. Really seen as like, oh my god, finally Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt, who are of course famously dating at this stage. We see the classic couple, surely going to make a lot of money. Costs $57 million and it makes $147 million. And if you think that conservatively films need to double their budget in order to break even, that is not a film that breaks even, because it makes $20 million over double its budget. And I bet with advertising costs, like, there's no way.
Hmm.
So, seen as a disappointment.
Given the star power, I wonder why.
I think the reviews are largely not good.
I went back and read the New York Times review, and it talks about this being released at the same time as Sopranos Season 3.
Ah.
As a kind of implies that there's some kind of synchronicity of marketing around Gandolfini as well.
Huh. I didn't even... think, when does this come out in terms of Sopranos?
So it's kind of starting to become a thing.
It's very... Anyway, we'll get to the Gandolfini discussion, an odd discussion. The next year, Verbinski makes The Ring, the American remake of The Ring.
I didn't know he made... Okay.
Incredible film. Have you ever seen it?
No, I've never seen either.
Extremely... I think... this is... Talk about controversial opinions. My controversial opinion is that the American remake of The Ring is better than the original. It's like... an exceedingly well-directed film.
Naomi Watts?
Naomi Watts. It's really good. And, in fact, so good that I watch it as a 14-year-old and become obsessed with, like, what's the next Verbinski vehicle? Do you know what the next Verbinski vehicle is? Made the year later?
Tell me.
You don't know the franchise that he's involved with?
I can't remember.
Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, of course.
The Curse of the Black Pearl.
Moneymaker.
So, if you look at this guy's career,
what's his background? What's his deal? Who is he?
He looks like this.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Everyone will just have to imagine what he looks like. Yeah, he's very weird. He is one of the filmmakers who, thanks to the younger generation of film critics, is being reappraised now. But at the time, no review singles him out as like an interesting or exciting director. So he's the journeyman of the late 90s and early 2000s. It's only now in retrospect that people are saying this is an interesting filmmaker. Which is interesting because after that first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, he makes The Weatherman with Nicolas Cage.
Oh.
Like a divorced dad, Nicolas Cage rom-com kind of. Then he makes second Pirates of the Caribbean, third Pirates of the Caribbean, Rango, the animated kids film.
Johnny
that's
Depp.
Yeah, that's like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, basically. Did you know that?
No.
The gecko is stylized to look like Hunter S. Thompson that's in very that funny. Film. The Lone Ranger, so...
Johnny Depp disaster.
Oh, yeah,
and
total
also
disaster.
Problematic as... Yeah. And also, yeah.
Army Hammer disaster.
That's right. Well, yeah, I feel like that really put a stopper on Army's trajectory.
There were a bunch of times where Army looked like he was on the cusp of something and, and it kept falling apart.
But which is... I think you get a much more interesting Army Hammer for that. I don't wish him ill, but although maybe he shouldn't have been in The Lone Ranger. But it's... fun to kind of watch him just turn up in places like, you know, the Boots Riley film. What was that?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry to Bother You.
Maybe his best performance.
It's amazing.
He's very good in that film. And then the reason why I'm invested in Verbinski, I think he's a perfect example of a filmmaker who every film he makes is well made. In fact, extremely well made. I think maybe we'll disagree, but I think The Mexican is like very competently directed. But then in 2016, he makes a little film called A Cure for Wellness. Do you know anything about this film?
Oh, I remember being advertised.
Beautiful, big budget, extremely expensive horror film, which is really, really good. That film cost $40 million. It made $26.6 million. So it puts the stopper on his career again. But the most fascinating, this is my last bit of Verbinski context. In the mid to late 2000s, Verbinski plays this game and he's like, I have to adapt this video game for the big screen. I need millions of dollars. He writes a script. It's an R-rated script. He's right up the way to the production. And then studio heads look at the script and they're like, we cannot have this fucking guy make this script for like hundreds of millions of dollars. Video game was BioShock.
Oh.
They were like a day before they were going to start shooting on BioShock, directed by Gore Verbinski, and they pull the plug.
I would watch that.
So what Verbinski does is take all the assets from that failed BioShock movie and make A Cure for Wellness. So if you watch A Cure for Wellness, it's got stunning production design and it's BioShock production design. He literally takes all of the discarded drawings and makes it like a weirdo horror film about like a spa in the European mountains set in indiscriminate year. And it's like a horror film that eventually becomes a Bride of Frankenstein riff. Crazy. Completely crazy. And that's all she wrote on Verbinski for the moment.
Hmm.
And maybe forever, unless he just like hitches himself to another franchise. Like an example of the filmmakers that we seem to talk about all the time who are like clearly have vision, but just they can't make original films in the current climate. So they have to, you know, do the Sam Raimi and be the director for like Doctor Strange 2 or some shit. Otherwise, no studio will give them the money. And they seem incapable of making small budget films again.
Maybe that's just Hollywood. It's just what happens is you just become like, you do well enough that it's impossible to maintain the momentum. So you crash.
I guess so. But why couldn't Gore Verbinski go away and make like a $6 million, do like a Joss Whedon, like film a Much Ado About Nothing in his expensive house? Like,
I respect that.
If you really want to work, why not do that?
I have to ask Gore.
As I say, he's now a hero in many communities.
That's really interesting.
People
love
Gore.
The thing that strikes me is I'm not sure really where The Mexican fits into that filmography. It seems kind of like an outlier.
So early.
Yeah.
What film does he think he's making?
I have no idea. It's totally baffling. It feels like you've had six directors come together and film different aspects of each scene. Like, because it's not even the sequences that seem juxtaposed and discombobulated. It's everything. It doesn't make sense in terms of any genre.
Well, the film is deliberately basically two separate road trips.
Yeah.
So it lends itself to a kind of kaleidoscopic tone.
Well, it's thriller and comedy, right?
It's not very funny.
No, but
did you laugh?
But, No.
No.
But it, I mean, there's a point, there's a scene where J.K. Simmons and Brad Pitt bump heads reaching for something. So it's obviously going for laughs.
I get. And Pitt is doing...
He's in a comedy. He's just in a comedy.
He's, this is Burn After Reading.
Yeah.
He does so many of the mannerisms that he will reuse in Burn After Reading here.
Yeah, with a little less confidence, I think.
True.
But absolutely. And also, he's not being directed by the Coen brothers, no. Right? But I had that thought because he's... Is this the first time he plays an idiot? I mean, since his, like, early career?
Since Cutting Class, since,
like,
yeah, perhaps.
First, like, three or four films?
Yeah, perhaps.
Like, a real
I'm
going
to have to check that just to make extremely sure. It's crazy that we can't really remember off the top of our heads which films we covered.
Yeah. It might be the first time he's an idiot since he was an idiot when he last acted with Gandolfini.
When did he last
True Romance.
Oh, yeah. Gandolfini's in that movie.
Where they're also... He's also a hitman.
Yeah, I guess so. Because it's True Romance, The Favour. He's a bit of an idiot in The
Favour.
He's
a bit of an idiot in The Favour. Although that was filmed well before True Romance, right? Yeah. Wasn't The Favour filmed like...
And nobody saw that film. So it doesn't... Interview with the Vampire, Legends of the Fall, Seven. Even 12 Monkeys, he's not an idiot in 12 Monkeys. He's just having a hard time.
Yeah.
Meet Joe Black, I guess he's kind of idiotic.
That's true.
It's kind of the joke of that film is that he's a knowing idiot. But it's just interesting that directors look at that guy. I guess it's the jock thing, right?
Yeah.
They're like, he just looks like an airhead.
Airhead is a nice way of putting it. I mean, you realise he's an idiot in The Mexican when he's being bossed around by Bob Balaban.
I mean, we have to talk about that. Yeah. Do you want to do the four sentence, Ken?
No.
Yes, you do.
I don't remember. I finished this morning...
Do you want me to do the four
sentence? Yeah, I did it last time and it was just... Oh, wait, we do it in turns? But you do... I would like you to do it this time. I will... I was thinking during this film, this is just not a film I want to do the four sentence game with.
You're stressed out by the four sentence game.
With some films. I mean, Snatch and The Mexican, come on.
The Mexican's convoluted. Pretty easy.
I suppose so.
Brad Pitt and Julia Roberts play disenfranchised lovers who break up because... He is indebted to a mob boss due to an accident involving a car crash. That means he now has to go to Mexico to retrieve a cursed pistol with a confusing backstory.
Racist backstory.
Pretty racist backstory. Julia Roberts gets kidnapped by a hitman played by James Gandolfini, who she discovers is gay. And with whom she develops a budding friendship as they go cross-country to try and get Pitt before he is found by the gangsters. Meanwhile, through a series of double crosses and betrayals, Pitt realizes that the gangster who is sending him to get the haunted pistol plans to kill him after he retrieves the pistol. Pitt and Roberts reunite. Pitt kills James Gandolfini in the dumbest decision this movie makes. Quite glibly. Anyway, we'll talk about it. That's a little aside. Dan gets the sides. That's my aside. And the two of them kill the gangster, head gangster, who tasked them with finding the pistol played by Bob Balaban. And they return the pistol to its quote-unquote rightful owner and drive away into the sunset together.
Wonderful. See, I think the reason the four sentence game stresses me out is because you're far better than me. Or I'm far worse than you, is a better way to put it. And knowing what to cut out. Because, like, there's another hitman involved that Gandolfini kills. Gandolfini has, like, a brief affair.
The affair is the best part of the film, perhaps.
Agree. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But that if the four sentence game is an attempt to do a skeleton...
Sure.
So listeners who have not watched The Mexican do not get... Lost.
I agree. I wish I had that skill. I just find it... I think I panic in the moment and think, what if I leave this thing out? Which actually speaks largely to my just general talking style as well, which is to caveat any claim I make as much as possible so that every condition is accounted for. James Gandolfini is the most important thing about this film, and without him it's a bad film.
Do you know an interesting thing? Taste is varied. People have different tastes. Like, people disagree. People who are very similar in a lot of ways disagree wildly on their evaluations of certain films. Mm. Like, there are people who I agree with much more than I agree with you, and we still have random disagreements where, like, someone who spends their whole life watching horror movies like me just doesn't like Hereditary. Like, this kind of shit happens all the time. Sometimes, in evaluation, you hit a work of art And it just has this quality that everyone agrees on. And in the case of The Mexican, I don't know the person who watches this movie and goes, James Gandolfini, not so good in this movie, maybe the expendable part of this film.
If we find a Letterboxd review that does not like James Gandolfini, we should have them on the podcast.
Damn, that's a genuinely good idea. Because what does that person look like?
Yeah.
Because Gandolfini plays a conflicted gay hitman who has, as you say, like an affair on the road, and he plays it for real. Is that James Gandolfini's biggest skill, I was thinking, when I was watching this film? Is it that he's the most sincere performer in the entire world?
Yeah, his earnestness. I've been rewatching The Sopranos, and his ability to, despite being a truly terrible person in that show, make your heart melt with, like, a just slight shift in his expression is perhaps genuinely unmatched.
Yes.
I think the only... And I know this is a cliche to cite this actor. The only person who I can think is comparable, and I don't even think in this particular way, is Hoffman, maybe? Philip Seymour Hoffman.
True.
Who also has quite, like, you know, prickly exterior, soulful interior. He can play that really well. I think Gandolfini would have been better in Synecdoche, New York, actually. Now that's
a good take, like, Daniel. Yeah.
Yeah, like, I would love to see him in that.
I mean, just that film gets more interesting if the main character is not nebbish New York playwright.
Yeah. Well, also, I think, so Gandolfini, I don't want to make judgments about anyone's appearance, but James Gandolfini is not a normative, handsome man. And yet...
He's attractive.
Beautiful and like...
I think he's not only beautiful, I think he's, like, sexually attractive.
Yeah, exactly. He's
like, hugely so.
He's hot.
Yeah.
I don't understand. I think it's just his eyes and smile. You don't see him and think leading man. Or, like, he's not Brad Pitt, right?
The thickness to his voice and the way he breathes through his nose is another quality that is, like, weirdly sensual and tactile.
Yeah. It's weird how believable it is that women in The Sopranos keep falling in love with Tony Soprano. Yeah, like, it's just believable.
Absolutely.
This, like,
the scene
charisma.
We could do, like, a sidebar on The Sopranos, but I don't know what we'd say other than just, like...
Very good.
Obviously excellent, transformative piece of art.
Although, I think I've been thinking a lot about how it would be good if it didn't have James Gandolfini in it. And it would still be a good show, but he's so important.
It is, and I don't just say this. I'm sometimes hard pushed to think of a better performance, full stop, than Gandolfini in The Sopranos. And I know what I sound like when you say but I watch it and I am awed. The moment in The Sopranos when Tony decides that he's in love with his therapist because she's the only person who's, like, addressed his obvious hang-ups and needs, that scene is just seared into my brain. So happy and so self-content that he's like, I love you. And she's like, Tony, you definitely don't love me. And he's like, I just do. Like, it's who else?
Yeah. He's having a dream, I think, in the first or second season. And he's walking down the new, like, boardwalk on the Jersey Shore. And he's grinning. There's a gif of it.
Yeah.
So just, if you haven't seen The Sopranos, just look up gifs of Tony Soprano to get a sense of what we're talking about in general. The man's energy.
It's unbelievable.
Unsurpassed, I think, genuinely.
I know you haven't seen the show, but I think the only thing that's comparable is Jon Hamm in Mad Men as Don Draper. I think that's also, like, one of my all-time favorite performances. But different. Draper is deliberately flinty. You do love Don sometimes, but you're not in the way you love Tony Soprano. Like, you really love... You always love Tony Soprano.
Yeah. Even when he's doing horrible things. Unforgivable things.
Absolutely unforgivable things. There's an episode of The Sopranos which ends with Tony... It's kind of been an episode about, like, the mafia infighting, and it's... And Tony's, like, not sure if he even wants to be a Don anymore, and he's sick of it, and his uncle is giving him such headaches, and there's no kind of verbal summation of his arc. He never says, like, I'm gonna keep being a gangster. Instead, the episode just ends with him taking a new recruit to the cafe where he hangs out with all of the other gangsters and introduces this new young recruit to the FBI agents who are, like, tapping and following Tony. Yeah. And, like, the FBI agents are very happy to be introduced. They're all like, hello, how are you? So it's like goodies versus baddies, just having this moment of, like, here's the new player in the game. It's genuinely transcendent art. Like, I think it's the level of storytelling that show had for so many years.
Unbelievable.
Is unmatched.
obviously Gandolfini is being cast in The Mexican because of his performance in The Sopranos, right? And they are playing to his murderer with a sensitive side,
yes,
archetype. But he's a very different character. He's an extremely different character. Not just because he's gay either.
I think the two things to say are, this film, despite feeling very regressive in terms of its race politics,
which we will get to,
and even its gender politics, we have to talk about that too, because that's a problem, somehow feels very forward-thinking in terms of its handling of queer issues.
Yeah.
Because of James Gandolfini, yeah, not true, because of the script. You could cast anyone else in the world and they would play this as a stereotype and it would seem wildly insulting. But
yeah,
the Gandolfini character has, as you say, this affair with a man who he meets. And afterwards, Gandolfini says to Julia Roberts, like, I loved him. And you, they believe it, just
yeah,
met.
Yeah, they met in a bar and spent maybe, what, like 12 hours together. The thing about what the script is written, so the way Gandolfini kidnaps Sandra Bullock and develops this relationship with her by giving her advice, basically. Yes. And I imagine either the reason they made him gay was to as a punchline,
yes,
which it isn't because of Gandolfini's performance, no, or because they didn't want to have the specter of Sandra Bullock being sexually assaulted.
Julia Roberts, sorry.
How many times have I called her Sandra Bullock?
I don't know. I think that was the first time. They are similar. They've had a similar archetype and culture.
The idea with the advice that he's giving is he can give her this advice about relationships because he's gay, right?
Yes.
That was how it's written. But in fact, what happens is you get James Gandolfini giving this advice because he's lived a full and complicated life. So that's what he gives to the script that is not in there and lends an enormous amount of power to the film, and also makes his death, which is stupid, at least moving. And you believe moving? Julia Roberts' pain. Well, it's moving in the way that you're very upset that it happened. I'll just say as a sidebar, the reason I don't think this film is competently directed is because it kind of feels like a mess.
The first 5 minutes, the first two shots of this film are going from a traffic light, a wide shot of a traffic light.
Which it ends on as well.
Yeah. That's an easy way to make sure your very messy film at least feels kind of streamlined, yeah, right? End on the same shot. Opens on a traffic light, a very nicely composed shot, and then it cuts to an extreme close-up of Pitt's face. And just that cut is more competent than, like, 89% of the films that we've watched so far.
Sure.
I think on a scene-by-scene level, Verbinski is just skilled and just has interesting ideas.
I mean, if we're to compare this to Snatch,
yes,
it's genuinely propulsive in its, in the way it's directed, in a way that Snatch isn't.
Yes, I definitely agree. I think we should put the Gandolfini plotline to bed.
Sure.
Much to the chagrin of reviewers of the time, Pitt and Roberts are apart for like 85% of the film. They're having their two separate road trips. Roberts with Gandolfini, Pitt with a donkey, and then a dog, and then kind of J.K. Simmons. And, I mean, every reviewer said this. By virtue of James Gandolfini, the Pitt section is so much less interesting. It's such a drag when they cut, like... Yeah. And not... Pitt is good. He's doing, great, like, funny haircut idiot. But he's not really
He's born to play.
Yes. But what's he doing?
Not much. He's not given anything to work with.
No.
And he's also... A lot of his conversations are with people who have... Who can't speak English as a punchline. Which, yes, is not great.
Yes.
This film is interesting because it attempts to undermine its racism. And I almost want to say admirably.
Yeah.
But not... Like, there's a few scenes where you're like, oh, I was... Like, for instance, there's a scene where J.K. Simmons breaks into a shop, holds up the shopkeep and abuses him in insultingly broken English, and the guy returns speaking English. Not that being able to speak English is a sign of obviously intelligence or anything like that. Right. And those are kind of the traps the film falls into.
It is trying to undercut assumptions.
But it doesn't do it that well.
No. I mean, it lays its cards quite firmly down on the table early on when Pitt first comes to Mexico and is asking for a hire car. And they give him a Chrysler. And he's like, I want something more Mexican. And the guy at the car shop is speaking to him in a language that Pitt doesn't understand, being like, you're going to have a shit time here. And Pitt's just kind of nodding along. So it does want to undercut his status as like white guy who thinks he understands the situation and is actually completely oblivious.
Which is supposed to be kind of the joke of this film, right? Is like the incompetent white guy in foreign Mexico.
Yeah.
Which has as all, whenever you go to Mexico, you've got to shoot it yellow because, well, Mexico is yellow.
I wanted to say something about that. We're like Inception style, we're conversation and conversation and conversation. I always believed that the film that starts the stereotype of Mexico has a yellow color filter was Traffic, directed by Steven Soderbergh, who we're going to have to start talking about real soon because he directs all the Ocean movies. But Traffic comes out in 2000, and this comes out in 2001. So unless the timing works out that Verbinski, like, walks out of a cinema just before he starts shooting The Mexican, it's unlikely that he's being influenced by Traffic here.
Is it the same studio, maybe? They're just putting color filters on everything?
I just think, like, Soderbergh used to talk a lot about his guilt for being the guy who starts that stereotype. Because the thing about Traffic is that, like, it's multiple storylines, each with its own color filter. Yeah. And it just so happened Mexico is yellow, but also, like, the politics stuff, the Washington, D.C. is very blue. Yeah. Like, it's very stylized. It's unfortunate. But I think the only defense, I'd say, of Verbinski doing the, Mexico yellow color filter is that he's consistent with it. Even in the opening scenes of the film, which are not set in Mexico, it's pretty yellow.
That's true. It's in like a abandoned kind of like hotel park. Well, not abandoned, but kind of a not great end of town. Things are a bit sparse.
Which is not to excuse an obviously racist trope.
The worst one is, I think, that so the MacGuffin of the story is obviously this pistol that Pitt is trying to get. And the pistol has this backstory about it being cursed. And whenever someone tells the story of the curse of the pistol, it goes to this kind of very
sepia-toned
Mexican village in some era, like ancient times. Kind of
very indiscriminate about its storytelling at this stage.
And there's just a series of caricatures of kind of Mexican characters, a Mexican wedding at which someone curses the pistol in such a way that it ends up. It doesn't matter, but the bride commits suicide and it takes on this aura. But there is this sense of like Mexico is where you go where things are a little bit magical, and there's this kind of the exoticism of it is very charged, and this kind of cursed backstory, which weirdly like everyone in Mexico seems to know. There's this sense of mythology, coherent, singular, reductive mythology that is very racist.
American directors of the 90s and the 2000s are obsessed with this idea of, I'm going to make a contemporary fairy tale and I'm going to set it in some far-flung country.
Yeah.
And of course, that is part of a colonialist, racist mindset of like, these foreign places are quote-unquote exotic.
Definitely. And it kind of allows for that, the flexibility in storytelling that you couldn't get away with in America.
Yes.
Because it just gets slid under the umbrella of foreignness and weirdness.
Yes, exactly. Which is problematic. The only other thing to say about the ways this film is problematic is that the Roberts character is pretty unsympathetically painted.
Right.
She's very... The joke at the beginning is that she's kind of nagging Pitt.
I mean, it's literally a throwing his suitcase out over the balcony scene. Yeah.
There is a funny joke where she's making him go to, like, marriage counselling group when they're not married. That's reasonably funny.
Yeah.
But she's kind of weirdly useless. And part of that is the fact that in this very cringeworthy scene, and obviously, you know, we're all mired in context and there's stuff that we have normalized now that will seem, I'm sure, abhorrent for other reasons in the future, but there's a scene that even in 2001 is pretty rough going, where the reason that Roberts knows that Gandolfini is gay is because he says that he won't rape her. And there's this scene where she's like, do you not think I'm like rapable, basically? It's really bad. Up to that point, I had been rather... I think the film's strongest part is its beginning. And it's definitely its weakest part is its last half an hour. But I had been enjoying the film up to that point. And then there's this really unpleasant scene.
Mm. I mean, that's not, like, the reason I don't like this film. But I think that does play... It is indicative of some of the decision-making of this film. Not just its political decision-making, but how it runs its story. Which I just find really difficult to stomach. It's also... I enjoy this more than Snatch, which we watched last week. I enjoy Pitt's performance quite a lot, which we haven't even talked about yet. Really,
he's good.
Only a little bit, but we haven't talked about it extensively. He looks great. His costumes are great.
His silly hair
is great. Pitt's a lot of fun. But yeah, I think there are there are elements of this film that I think are, like, aggressively and dangerously dumb.
There is, to talk about what's good about Pitt's performance, I think the scene that exemplifies it comes early, where Pitt is having to kind of transport this young man who's very drunk, who's peeing in an alleyway, and who just kind of collapses. And Pitt assumes that he's so drunk that he's passed out. So Pitt loads him into his car and then goes like, oh, you've hit your head, because he's got blood on his hands all of a sudden. And Pitt slowly realizes that there are a nearby group of revelers who have been firing guns in the air, and one of the bullets fell down and hit this guy in the head and killed him.
The guy sees Pitt sees the hole in this guy's hat and then looks in his head violent. And is like, oh,
you
this
see
film
like
has some weird flashes of violence.
You see like a hole in the dude's head.
There's this trope in films that I find infuriating, which is, how stupid is this character? As stupid as we need him to be to move the plot forward or to make a joke.
He's pretty consistently dumb in this movie.
I guess so. But like, it feels like that's astonishingly, like, not realizing that someone you're picking up is dead and not asleep.
It's a really good gag, though. And he plays it very well.
He does play it really well. That's the thing, is Pitt's really good at that.
Yeah.
Pitt is convincingly stupid.
What's the most meaningful thing he does as a character to drive the action forward?
Make mistakes.
Kill Gandolfini.
Yeah.
That's his quote-unquote hero moment. And because of the way the film is, we don't think it's a hero moment.
We don't want him to
all.
Do that. And the film obviously realises that this is not something you're revelling in, because it doesn't even show you kill him. And once he's dead, you don't see his face, really.
No. Well, because what happens is they're behind a car pulling guns on each other, and you hear a shot from Roberts' perspective, and she runs back. And there's the moment of, oh, which of them has been shot?
Yeah.
And it's disappointing that it's not Pitt being shot. I mean,
and this is the Brad Pitt cast.
Exactly.
And that's absolutely true.
But you really want Pitt to be dead. Right? Gandolfini feels like the heart and soul of this film.
Undoubtedly.
And he feels like the comic frisson on the top.
It's, and I don't think it's just because I've been watching The Sopranos, but it was just such a joy every time he was on screen. I think this is, a kind of important film in the Pitt canon to some extent, because obviously this is maybe at the height of his box office powers, or at least...
Oceans is around the corner, and that's like a new era, really.
That's true, but he's being cast in that for the box office power. I guess the same with this. But he's not being a classic, handsome, straightforward leading man. Which, again, is not like... Even Meet Joe Black, there is more of that. Like, there's no sex scene in this, for instance.
No.
Which is interesting.
That's true, actually.
I think it might be one of the first films where Pitt doesn't have his shirt off.
He doesn't have his shirt off in stuff like Sleepers. But in this film, he's really positioned as like a romantic object.
Yeah, we've got Pitt the Star. I guess what I mean is, we have Pitt the Star, but Pitt the Star is doing some interesting things. Or like, obviously wanting to. And also just, again, we talked about this a lot early on in the podcast, but we have the physical movements we've come to know and love and will come to see be increasingly refined.
Yes.
He gets to really like dance around a bunch.
Yeah.
It's when, though, the scene where, I think Pitt just fucking eats this up, when he realizes the bullets are falling from the sky, and you have this kind of slightly wide shot where you get to see him like leap back and forth as if he's dodging the bullets.
Yeah. And he's screaming like, stop it, man,
yeah,
or something
exactly.
like that.
Very like pantomimish kind of exaggerated movements. So it's a lot of fun.
My big question is, do you think that Pitt is on set and he knows, I've got the shittier half of this movie?
Probably. Because doesn't have anyone to play off, right? Like,
except
J.K.
Simmons.
I love J.K. Simmons.
I do too.
But J.K. Simmons is not that interesting in this movie.
It's kind of an In Bruges setup with the two of them.
Yeah, and that could have been more interesting. I think it's a problem with the script. I could totally imagine J.K. Simmons and Brad Pitt having a great... But they never
I mean,
really...
they're in Burn After Reading together.
Oh, of course.
But they have no scenes?
I don't think so. Oh, no,
J.K. Simmons
is... He just bookmarks the film.
Yeah, he's in an office.
Yeah. Great movie. Looking forward to it. I think it must be frustrating for Pitt that he's in a film of this caliber. He gets to bounce off Bob Balaban, which is genuinely fun. Those scenes are great.
This is what we have to talk about. We said it just before we started recording. Early on in this film, when you hear about this Mafia Don, you know that Pitt's going to meet the Mafia Don. He's kind of nervous. It's a big deal going to meet this Mafia Don. And the door opens, and it's Bob Balaban playing a man named Bernie. And it's just great.
Yeah,
like, I love Bob Balaban so much. I really, really love him. He's so funny.
One of the best faces in Hollywood, I think.
One of the best actors. Yeah. I genuinely think that.
He is unbelievable in this film.
When are you not happy to see Bob Balaban?
Yes.
And also, when does he not elevate material?
Yes.
Constantly.
What is his filmography? I have to quickly look. Like
Gosford Park.
He's in Gosford Park. He's in Midnight Cowboy, is he?
I don't remember that.
He plays the young student.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that.
I don't think I remember that. I haven't seen that film in quite a
while. I saw it maybe a year ago, maybe 6 months ago. I do remember him turning up. I don't remember, I think maybe it was in an art school or something.
Really?
I don't know.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Never seen it.
Prince of the City, the Sidney Lumet film.
Oh.
So good. Crime drama. He's really good in that film. Yeah, weird career. Bob Roberts. Have you ever seen that film? Mm-hmm. Tim Robbins directed it.
Oh.
It's like a piss take of the central gimmick is, what if there was a conservative Bob Dylan? And so Robbins plays this right-wing guy, and it turns out that he's being, bankrolled by an evil senator who's responsible for, Iran-Contra and stuff.
Pretty funny.
It's a pretty good movie. Ida the dog is getting up, eating something random off the floor.
Speaking of bit parts in The Mexican,
about Gene Hackman.
No, it has Puma Man in it. This is Ida's footsteps on the wooden boards.
Ida's coming.
Mystery Science Theater 3000. One of the best Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes. It's on YouTube if you want to watch it. It's called Puma Man, about a guy who gets the powers, like a scientist in a museum. He gets the powers of Puma Man. And there is a kind of racist caricature of an ancient Incan, I believe, who appears to him and gives this kind of nebbish white guy these powers because he's inherited them. It's a really fantastic... Mystery Science Theater 3000 is like a riff on bad movies show with the original version of that. It's fantastic. And I saw this guy in the background of one of the final shots. And I was like, that's Puma Man.
That's funny.
I looked him up, and it's actually hard. I Googled the Mexican Puma Man. Nothing comes up. I had to find this guy's name.
That's amazing.
Didn't even come up with Googling. Had to look through the IMDb cast, full cast of the Mexican to ensure that.
You have to find that and tweet it. There's two people. Yeah, no one knows that. Would be very exciting.
Absolutely no one knows. Just give me a second. I'll see if I can find the guy's name. Keep talking and I'll just look it up on the side.
Well, I thought you were going to say the film's most significant cameo is in the last half an hour. Gene Hackman, who I don't think I even remembered. Come here, dog. Are you licking the floor? Come here. Ida has settled in well to the new house. I think the listeners of the Pitcast need to know this. She was extremely naughty the first night we were here. She would not go to sleep, but she has now decided that she's perfectly happy living here on her nice comfy bed and licking peanut butter off the floor is what I was assuming she was just doing.
She seems very content. Miguel Angel Fuentes.
If it sounds like we're not being firm enough in saying it, this is a racist film. This is a film with a racist backdrop about the journey of two white people that deliberately minimizes the stories of the people in the country that they're in.
Definitely. The Mexico is used as kind of a prop.
Yes.
More or less. A background against which a white person can have their journey. The gun has a wedding ring attached to it, which when Julia Roberts shoots Bob Balaban in the final scene,
very
flies
unfortunate.
Off
I wish Bob Balaban didn't die in this movie.
Yeah, and the two best... probably the two best performances in the film, honest. And Pitt takes the ring, but from this sacred gun, more or less, and... kind of one of the Mexican guy, he's like, can I propose to her with this ring? And the Mexican guy's like, it would be our honor. So there's even the permission of the white guy to appropriate the Mexican heritage.
Yeah. Written by a white guy, obviously, this film, and filmed by a cast and created.
And then also, I don't know if we've actually mentioned this, but the title of The Mexican refers to the gun.
It's not a bad title.
No. And it's better than referring to a person, probably.
Yes, exactly. When this film finishes...
Doesn't pass the Bechdel test either. Anyway, I don't think there's even two women in it.
No, but you know what doesn't pass the Bechdel test?
Tell me.
Beau Travail, Denis film.
Sure.
Or any Claire Denis film. The Bechdel test, I'm sorry, I know how I know the optics of being a guy criticizing the Bechdel test, but... I mean, Claire Denis is our foremost filmmaker of critiquing toxic masculinity, and she does that by making films that have almost no women in it.
Yeah.
Beau Travail getting a new Criterion collection.
I
did you see the front cover?
It's beautiful. Yeah.
It's very exciting. Have you seen any Denis except for High Life?
I think I might have seen one other, but I can't remember it.
The Queen?
No.
Maybe I'm saying she's the Queen.
Oh, okay. thought she directed a film called The Queen.
I have to put my knees up, Dan. My arthritis has been so bad.
I'm sorry, Joseph.
Sorry, I bumped all the chairs. You know, I've had arthritis in my legs since I was 8 years old.
I hate that for you.
I used to cry when it was time to go to assembly at my English primary school because you had to sit with your legs crossed. And it was... Sorry, is my phone buzzing too? Oh, it's just a... You know what this is like? This is... like the end of the Mexican. Our podcast is just falling apart. We were going well, and then the third act. Yeah.
Disintegrating.
As a kid, my parents used to make fun of me because I would just be like rubbing my knees like an old man sitting in a chair. Pretty bad. What I was going to say is when I reflect on this film, it has the misfortune of all the worst stuff is in the last 30 minutes. So when the credits roll, you're like...
left with a bad impression.
Yeah, you've
pretty
been...
boring last 30 minutes.
Really. When they get rid of Gandolfini.
Yeah. Also a lot of exposition for some reason.
Yeah.
You don't have exposition in the last 30.
No. Oh, well, I mean, we haven't even talked about this very useless twist that Gandolfini was not who he said he was.
I don't think that matters for the film. It feels like this was like the fourth rewrite of the film.
It feels like an attempt to be like Gandolfini was a bad guy.
But you don't
but
believe
I'm not
it
convinced.
Because it's
no.
James Gandolfini.
Yeah, and he was the sweetest, nicest part of the movie.
Yeah, and so earnest that it's impossible that he was putting that on.
Yes. But Balaban, maybe I feel like I haven't stressed enough, plays the role of the Mafia Don like he's Bob Balaban. And the thing I always push for in movies is, even if you get the world's most boring script and you have to make it and you can't change it, just do interesting stuff with it. And the decision to be like, here's the Mafia Don, let's just cast Bob Balaban
and tell him
get him
to
not play it threateningly. You could try and kind of put some canted angles and make him look scary, but he's just Bob Balaban. Yeah, there's a scene where he's like giving the evil villain speech to one of his henchmen and he's like, the difference between you and I is that we don't know when we're getting fucked. And he's saying it like he's the IT guy at your workplace. Like, there's no real menace to it. It's very conversational. I mean, I gave this film 3 stars. What would you give it?
2.5.
Okay. For
Gandolfini.
What does it slot in under?
I mean, this is the problem I have with this kind of ranking, right? Is because Gandolfini's performance is one of the best of any film we've watched. Pitt's performance is very good.
It's a little weird, and this is more a comment on kind of American cinema of this time, because he did become such a titan. It's weird that pretty much every major actor that we're talking about this film worked with Steven Soderbergh in a major way.
Hmm.
I mean, Soderbergh directs Roberts in Erin Brockovich, which is like her comeback vehicle. He directs that film the same year that he makes Traffic. And he's like 2 years off making a film with Brad Pitt.
Soderbergh is significant. He works with everyone, right?
Do you know how old he was when he made Sex, Lies, and Videotape?
No.
I have to find it precisely. It's going to make you quite unwell, because it makes me quite unwell. I don't know.
He's still pretty young, right? Like, he's not...
Yeah. When you walked in the door, I was watching a Soderbergh I've never seen. I was watching The Limey, because like, whenever I read an interview with Soderbergh, or I hear other people talk about Soderbergh, I'm like, why don't I love that guy?
Yeah.
Like, he's so smart. He knows so much about movies. But I don't think I like many Soderbergh films.
I tried to watch the new Netflix one with Meryl Streep.
Oh, well, she does blackface in that film.
Oh, does she? Yeah. I didn't get to that bit.
Yeah, that film's terrible.
It's boring.
The Laundromat.
I watched, like, the first half hour. And was it had a bunch of people I like in it.
Soderbergh is 57 now. So he was born in 63. And Sex, Lies, and Videotape comes out in 89, so he's 26
when it comes out.
Movie. Yeah,
so he's probably making it when he's like 24.
Fucking dickhead. I mean, we will talk about him real soon, but like,
well, PTA was like 12 when he made.
That's true.
Hard Eight, right?
But PTA doesn't feel like he counts because PTA was the son of an entertainment LA guy.
Sure.
Soderbergh, I think, is just this whiz kid, strange, nerdy, slightly abrasive young man. Yeah, we'll undoubtedly talk about it. But you know, he makes Sex, Lies, and Videotape and becomes the youngest ever director to win a major award at Cannes. Then he makes Kafka, which flops. King of the Hill, which flops. The Underneath, which flops. Schizopolis, which flops. Grey's Anatomy, which flops. Out of Sight, which does okay with George Clooney. The Limey, which flops. And then, in the same year, 2000,
He makes Erin Brockovich and Traffic.
That's crazy.
Both of which get nominated for Best Director. So he competes against himself in the Best Director category.
Did he win?
Yes. So he had, like, higher odds than any other director in history to win. That's, yeah. How do you assess, like, which Soderbergh is better directed?
You would also think you would split the ticket in some ways. Because didn't it not used to be preferential voting for the Academy Awards?
Should we do some Letterboxd?
Absolutely.
Soderbergh also did the two-part Che Guevara film. Have you seen that?
No.
Maybe his best film.
Oh. Are you enjoying The Limey?
I'm like 20 minutes in. I really love Terrence Stamp. Do you know Stamp?
No.
British actor with a very deep voice.
I probably, yeah.
He's in the Eddie Murphy film, The Haunted Mansion, if you've seen that film. You're missing out, Dan. I don't know what to tell you. Great film. Soderbergh works with Paul F. Tompkins on The Informant. Like,
oh, that's right.
He's like a comedy guy.
That's funny.
I mean, we'll talk about him eventually.
He's made a lot of movies.
He's made a lot of movies. And we're going to talk about three of them.
That's crazy. In relatively quick
succession. Yes. Right? What are we going to do? What conversations will we have by the time we reach? 13, yeah. Fucking hell. All right. The Mexican. What do you think the average rating is?
2.9.
2.7.
Oh, wow.
You're close.
Hmm.
If you look at the graph, the overwhelming rating is right down the middle.
Yeah.
We've talked about him before. Mike D'Angelo, the film critic, has, as I've said before, a couple of blind spots, which I think means that he's a problematic critical voice. He has a blind spot when it comes to race, and he has this very famously quite offensive review of Spike Lee's film Chirac, where he just doesn't really criticize the film. He criticizes the methods Lee suggests might help African-American people come out of disenfranchisement. So as a white guy criticizing a specific political worldview, he was called out quite eloquently by a really good critic called Kay Austin Collins. So if you go to Mike D'Angelo's, because it happened on Letterboxd, it was a back and forth between them in the comments. It's quite astonishing. If you go to Chirac, it's all still up because D'Angelo is... He's the one with, like, he has a specific rating out of 100. So he gives films like 69 or 72 or whatever.
Incredible.
And he reposts
all insane of, also.
Yes. He reposts all of his old reviews again. So this is the review that he wrote in 2001 for Time Out New York that he's reposted on Letterboxd. Pitt and Roberts may rank among the world's most popular movie stars, but I suspect many of you are nonetheless thinking that you'd rather chew plywood than watch them play bickering lovers for 2 hours. Why?
Which they don't.
Well, fear not. With the exception of a handful of scenes near the beginning and the end, the two share no screen time. Instead, inept bagman Jerry, working off his debt to a mob boss he accidentally sent to prison, winds up alone south of the border trying to retrieve the pistol.
I can't stand a review that's just describing the plot.
He does have some moral valence at the end. Confidently directed by noted music video veteran Gore Verbinski, The Mexican starts off endearingly goofy and shaggy dog. There's a terrific running gag involving a rental car dealer accustomed
to... It's not terrific.
No, it's really not. Accustomed to gringos.
It happens twice, which I don't think is a running gag.
But acquires surprising depth of feeling along the way, thanks largely to...
James Gandolfini.
Gandolfini's towering performance.
All of us. It brings us all together.
He's somehow able to make a potentially self-conscious line like, I'm just here to regulate funkiness, sound perfectly natural.
Yeah.
That's very true. It's a good line to point out. And while the Brad-Julia relationship is disappointingly pro forma, there's eccentricity aplenty on the picture's fringes. From Balaban's odd killer accountant vibe.
I hate this prose so much, but I kind of agree with
that. I mean, all the points of what we've said. To a Mexican car thief struggling to convince Jerry not to shoot him in the foot. If you can hear sudden shouts, it's my partner Brianna upstairs in a work call. It's a wonder that the movie doesn't shoot itself in the foot, haha. But against the odds, this one emerged from the dream factory with its soul largely intact.
This is a nightmare.
That's the whole review. Have we ever talked about D'Angelo's top four films? I think we have.
What are they?
Manhattan is one of them.
Still.
Yeah.
You know Woody Allen went on Alec Baldwin's podcast.
Did he really? Yeah. Spike Lee defended Woody Allen recently. Dear. And then Paul Schrader on Facebook defended Spike Lee for defending Woody Allen. Maybe I don't want to
wait. What are the other three films?
We've talked about it before. Because we called out Manhattan last time. I'm giving you different reviews. Don't you think you...
would not agree with someone who gives this film half a star.
Oh, definitely not.
That it's, film it's has a...
Yeah.
That half a star from this person who doesn't have top four films. This really sucked. Brad Pitt wears cargo pants and blue tinted sunglasses the entire time.
I like that. I'll pay that, actually. That's really funny.
This is a weird one. This is a half a star. Brad Pitt goes to Mexico and stumbles his way to victory in all areas of his life. I mean, that's kind of the joke of the film. It doesn't seem... Unless you're making a comment on the racial politics.
Maybe this is a person who describes films and just gives them star ratings.
I guess so. Here we go. Half a star. Let's do the top four. This film's a pro, which means that they're paying Letterboxd a little bit of money, not the most amount of money.
Okay.
Which is always... Anyway. Letterboxd pay me and I'll have those discussions. But when you're pro, you don't get the header image.
Yeah.
And it's like $2 more to be a patron. So I don't know why you wouldn't just be a patron.
$2 a month? Or?
Yeah. So it adds up. This person's top four films. Cloud Atlas. Directed by the Wachowskis.
Racially problematic.
And Tikva. We've never told this story in the podcast before, that you, me, friend of the podcast, Ned, were standing in line at the town hall in Sydney, waiting to see... Was it Parasite?
I think it might have been High Life. Maybe it was Parasite.
No, because... Yeah, maybe it was High Life. It was the three of us. Yeah. No, it was Parasite because it was a day screening. And we went up for noodles afterwards. We were standing there, for some reason, talking about Hugo Weaving.
Mm.
And I said quite loudly, the craziest thing about Hugo Weaving is that, like, 8 years ago, he was in a movie called Cloud Atlas, where he has, like, very racially insensitive prosthetics on to play an Asian man. And why haven't we cancelled Hugo Weaving yet? I think I said like that. And was it you or Ned? Someone said, he's actually standing just there.
Yeah, I think it might have been me.
Anyway, he should be told, right? Like,
I mean, I'm sure he knows. But yeah, we shouldn't... I mean, there's something to say, be said about saying things behind people's backs. I mean, you don't want to also approach a man in the street just for the sake of...
Hugo Weaving, do you remember in 2012?
That's what we need to be doing.
Cloud Atlas, despite these incredibly problematic elements, is a wild film. What book are you looking at?
Oh, no.
Go ahead, say it for the podcast.
Just the... Wendell Berry, and the... Because I've only noticed recently that Penguin has those really nice editions, because I have one with, like, the...
The orange spine?
The Barry Dayton self. Yeah. I was wondering... Actually, I was specifically thinking about Barry Dayton, because self is quite an evocative name for a book.
It's philosophy.
That makes sense.
All up here is the philosophy.
Because I've been reading Citizen by Claudia Rankine, and it has that... It's that Penguin edition.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And I'm really struck by that. So I was like, oh, there's two of those up there.
I have quite a lot of them. Yeah, with the orange spine.
Sorry, yeah, they have an orange spine, but like a white cover. So not a traditional Penguin orange all the way over. They're like a slightly upmarket.
They're real good.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry, Joseph.
Cloud Atlas. Broadcast News. Have you seen that
film? I don't think so.
You would love that film.
Yeah.
Holly Hunter, William Hurt, Albert Brooks.
Oh, yeah. Is that I'm not going to take it anymore? I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take
it
anymore?
No, that's Network.
Network, oh, okay.
Network's an unbelievable film.
Okay.
I think
I always thought that was the same film. I haven't seen either of them.
Network is like scathing, furious commentary on the American media system. Uh-huh. Broadcast News is... Rom-com, basically. Okay. I don't like that film.
But I would like it.
Implicated in the rom-com is like... She's choosing between two men who represent different ways of telling the news.
Cool.
No, you would really like it.
Okay.
People adore Broadcast News.
Okay.
At least two people listening to this podcast just thought, like, fucking Joe, like, what is wrong with him? Why doesn't he like... Look at those ratings for Broadcast News. Five star. Its average rating is 3.9. Like, people fucking love that film. A Fish Called Wanda.
Don't know it. I mean, I know of it, but I've never seen it.
John Cleese.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin Klein. I don't like it so much.
Okay.
I actually haven't reviewed it, although I've seen it. I'm going to give it 2.5 stars right here.
Yeah, you heard it here first,
folks. Yeah, breaking news. And then a film I've never heard of called The Wrong Guy.
Oh.
Starring Dave Foley and Jennifer Tilly. Oh, I was thinking of the wrong movie. This one-star review. No story, no substance, no charm, no excitement, no reason to exist, and Verbinski's usually fantastic visual style is as blank here as Pitt's t-shirts. Is he wearing t-shirts?
don't think... Isn't he wearing college? I don't know. I guess he's not wearing a pattern t-shirts.
And this, which is definitely true, which we didn't mention, it's Tarantino inspired.
Oh, sure.
It's very Tarantino. Yeah.
Which...
Hip, hitman, quirky backstory.
Two in a row, I guess. But what did we watch before Snatch? It's crazy that we forget.
It freaks me out that we
forget. It does, me too. I think... And they all blur.
Being John Malkovich.
Okay.
So completely different.
But two Pulp Fiction-y...
So it's Fight Club was 99.
Yeah.
So was John Malkovich, actually. So yeah, two
and
Pulp
then
Fiction.
Immediately thing. After Pulp Fiction, we have two films in that vein.
Which makes the next film we're going to do very odd. Because the next film is Spy Game. The Tony Scott directed throwback, 3 Days of the Condor, deliberately old-fashioned political thriller. That will
kind be a last gasp.
Weird episode. Do you know what you're going to say about that film?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good, but you ultimately didn't like it. 2.2.
Sure, I bet.
What's the next film that you're going to love?
I saw Ocean's 11 at the cinema and really liked it.
Did you?
Yeah, I remember.
The film after that is Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which you've never seen and I think you would like.
Okay.
I mean, I could probably predict this whole list.
Yeah, probably pretty well.
Like, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I think it'd be pretty funny if you're like, have you?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
I'm sure I have. I don't remember when, but I'm sure I've seen it. I think I saw it at, like, someone's house, like a sleepover or something.
There's no way that's, like, secretly a great film, is there?
I don't think so. I think it's bad.
Should we do a 5-star? Should we do 2 5-stars?
Yeah, let's do 2 5-stars.
Lovely. This review is just The Slay 5-stars. This review is nice and romantic.
It's not. I mean, I guess Gandolfini is nice and romantic.
5 stars.
He's the only romantic character in the film.
Pitt was hysterical, but Gandolfini was good too. Good.
Wash your like the butt
mouth,
there.
Mouth out. Okay, I guess we read this one. For the record,
what's the top four, do you know
how many 5-star reviews there are? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't think I've ever seen a film
that's
with so
amazing.
Few 5-stars.
That's surprising to me. Because, I mean, every film is someone's favourite and someone's least favourite.
Everybody knows that Gandolfini is the best thing in this movie and they shoot him. And then you've got to sit there for fucking 40 minutes.
Impossible to give it 5 stars.
Yes. Who on earth would think that's a good... Anyway, so we have to do 4.5. Okay, this person's... I think I follow this person. And I think they follow me. Yes! That's so funny. This is a guy I follow on Twitter and have followed for years. Like a mutual,
crazy.
A film mutual.
I mean, I guess not that crazy.
It's pretty crazy. Yeah. I found him because he gave The Mexican 4.5 stars. Here's his top 4 films. I knew they were good. Anyway. McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Have you seen that?
No, we almost saw that, but we didn't for some reason. I think one of us was sick or something. Like
you and I?
Yeah, it was on at the Ritz or something. Yeah.
I bought tickets.
And I think maybe I couldn't make it.
Yeah.
Something happened.
Sounds right.
Why?
Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. Have you seen that film?
No.
David Bowie, Japanese prisoner of war camp drama.
Hmm.
It's got a famous song. I've never actually seen it, but it's got a lot of 5 stars here. That's a surprise to me. Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, which is the film
crazy.
I was watching.
Crazy.
What
coincidence is all over the place.
And The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, directed by John Cassavetes.
Okay, is that good?
Fantastic.
Yeah, I should really watch
all the Cassavetes. Yeah. That's not true. They're not all great, but that's a very good one. And he recently watched, as did I, Malcolm X. And he gave it 4.5 stars, which I gave it to.
Yeah.
It's a great film. But you're not sold on Spike Lee, are you?
I've only seen...
Black Klansman.
Black Klansman, I didn't like it.
I don't like that film very much.
Yeah.
You haven't seen Do the Right Thing.
No, I was looking it up today. Because I think the his new Netflix film, and I was thinking I have
Five
to watch
Bloods.
Do the Right Thing. Yeah.
You do have to watch Do the Right Thing. Dan, Do the Right
I was also listening to a song from the Do the Right Thing soundtrack this morning.
Do the Right Thing, obviously one of the 10 best films ever made.
Whoa, okay.
I've told you that before.
Yeah, probably. Look, we talk a lot about a lot of films, Joseph.
Aaron's review. It's not a love story. It's a story about love.
On board.
Gandolfini's best non-television role.
Great. Sure.
Nah, he's better in Killing Them Softly.
I forget he's in that. I'm looking forward
to that. He's unbelievable in that film. You only have to wait like 40 weeks.
Yeah.
You have to watch Mr. and Mrs. Smith and Troy first, man. You have to eat your vegetables before you get your dessert. I have a new favorite of Fabinski.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
That's the review.
Okay.
Do you know
something? I'm glad he made a single about Gandolfini. You got it.
Do you know an interesting thing that we kind of haven't commented on? We'll just say now and then read this next review. Someone's review is just a romp! Exclamation mark.
An interesting thing that we haven't commented on is that basically from the beginning of this podcast, we have been checking in with Brad Pitt pretty much every year. If you look at the chronology of what has been going on,
there might be like a couple of missed years early on, right?
I don't even know if that's the case. I have to open up. Do you know what my most frequently visited tab on my phone is? Wikipedia.org Brad Pitt filmography. I just Google search it so many times. Yeah. So, I mean, Dark Side of the Sun, 88. Cutting Class, 89. Mm. Across the Tracks, 90. Thelma and Louise, 91. Johnny Suede, 91. Contact? Did we do Contact?
There's a reason we...
Oh, it's a short film. Yeah. It's not the movie.
It's not Contact, yeah.
Cool World, 92. River Runs Through It, 92. California, 93. True Romance, 93. The Favour, 94. Interview, 94. Legends of the Fall, 94. Seven, 95. 12 Monkeys, 95. Sleepers, 96. Devil's Own, 97. 7 Years in Tibet, 97. So, most years he's got like two
all
movies.
All years so far. Oh, yeah, most two.
98, Meet Joe Black. 99, Fight Club. 99, Being John Malkovich. 2000, Snatch. 2001 The Mexican, 2001 Spy Game, 2001 Ocean's 11, 2002 Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, 2003 Sinbad Legends of the Seventh Seas, and then 2004 Troy, Ocean's 11, 2005 Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
He's working.
And then when we hit, we'll have this weird thing happens that in 2007, the assassination of Jesse James year, we don't check back on him for like another 2 years. We don't see him again for another three years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's very odd.
Well, you get it, right? Like, I mean...
He's bored? He doesn't want to make movies anymore?
Probably. I mean, and he's been in... Well, he doesn't need to.
But he's got...
But he talks about the shift to production, right?
I guess so.
He's and just being like... not as interested. Like, well, not that he's not interested in acting, but all the trapping that comes with acting. He also... Does he have kids around that time as well?
I think he has them much earlier. He has them shortly after getting together with Jolie, right?
Anyway.
You know Soderbergh? Do you remember Steven Soderbergh saying that he was retiring from movies?
Yeah, I do. There was like
Matt Damon
about
broke
it.
The story. Yeah. And then he made like... How
he
many
made
films?
Like five films.
Eight, yeah, like two a year. Yeah. Shot on his iPhone in his backyard. Chris Gallo. Top four films. The Burbs. Directed by Joe Dante.
Don't know.
You haven't seen it?
No.
You'd like it.
Okay.
Tom Hanks.
I love Tom Hanks.
80s, like, bizarro.
COVID survivor
Tom Hanks.
Oh, my God.
There's an early episode of this podcast where we joked about Tom Hanks. And if he had died of COVID, we would have to have gone back and scrubbed that episode.
They're still making that Elvis film, apparently.
Oh, they resumed production
and did
already.
Did you hear that, like, the crew of Avatar got flown into New Zealand privately to make, like, Avatar 7 or whatever?
Have you seen the first Avatar?
Yeah, I saw it twice. I saw it in the Netherlands for some reason.
What?
With Ned.
Did you?
Mm-hmm.
Halloween. John Carpenter's Halloween. You haven't seen it yet?
No.
Great film.
Okay.
Did I get that for you? In the Christmas haul?
No, I don't think so.
Foolish. Oh, I got you the thing.
Yeah.
Adventures in Babysitting, directed by Chris Columbus. Never seen it. Chris Columbus, weird director.
Harry Potter.
Harry Potter and Home Alone. An Airplane.
Oh, I love that film. Very funny.
Extremely funny.
Yeah.
Unbelievably funny. Yeah. What? That's because you like that. It's a mad world vein of like...
Definitely. Slapstick.
Here's a ton of jokes.
Give me... That's why I like 30 Rock so much.
Yeah.
It's just if you give me 100 jokes a minute, some of them will probably be funny.
Yeah.
I can forget the ones that aren't.
Here we go, here's the review. I realize I'm in the minority here, but I love this movie and I don't get why other people don't. Perhaps it's because I saw it years after its initial release. I don't think that...
That doesn't explain.
Peak hotness Brad Pitt, circa 1999 to 2005. Tell me I'm wrong. You're wrong.
You're wrong, incorrect.
You're definitely wrong.
In fact, I would say he's hotter before this and after this.
Yes, exactly. He's extremely hot in Ad Astra.
Yeah.
Despite it being a problematic movie. A non-stereotypical gay character, that's true.
Important.
A great Alan Silvestri score. The score sucks.
Yeah, the score is bad. Like, the score is very performative
and
bad.
Janky
and, like,
and
it's
Ennio Morricone ripper.
It does the thing the score shouldn't, which takes you out of the film.
Yeah. A witty, kooky script matched with an equally kooky director.
I'll run a million miles from kooky.
Gore Verbinski, who later made some overblown pirate movies, if you get what he means. And you have a charming romantic comedy adventure that is a sheer hoot
from beginning to end.
What did the other person call it? A blast?
Yeah, hoot and a blast. This film is not a hoot. Nor a blast.
No. James Gandolfini, I would say, are you a James Gandolfini fan? Fast forward and watch his bits.
Stop the film before he gets shot as well.
Yeah,
let him live in your memory as a character who, with his own agency.
Which is kind of what I was struggling with when I was thinking about, do I like movies? Which is, I say this is a film I don't like, but I'm, I'm in awe of Gandolfini's performance. So how do I reconcile that?
Yeah.
Don't know. You'll find out on later episodes of the Brad Pitt cast. It's like I didn't need to struggle with my...
In the last episode...
Love for this genre.
When we listen to rewatch... Yeah. When we rewatch Ad Astra, that episode will also double as the episode where Dan unveils his Brad Pitt ranking.
Okay, that's unfair. Just so you know. Yeah, for sure.
You have to rank every film. I have to blow out the candle because it's about to blow up. There you go. Nice little bit of ASMR. Should I blow out the other one?
Yeah, and then please. We'll
say goodbye. It's a bit like that joke in the Mike Myers comedy, I Married an Axe Murderer. He delivers stand-up slam poetry and at the end picks up a candle and goes...
pretty funny.
Signify the ending. That's a good film.
Beautiful. Good smelling candles, Joe.
Watermelon and vetiver and cardamom. Do you know about vetiver?
No, I've never heard of it.
It's in 80% of perfumes.
Huh.
Smell this. This is what vetiver smells like. What's it derived from? It's a flower. I'm obsessed with it as a scent by itself. It's really nice. Smoky.
Deep. So, yeah, I mean, it's smoky because also the candle is smoking. So, it's hard to distinguish. Damn. It is beautiful.
Don't sass me in that manner.
Sorry.
Next week, we'll be here to talk about the Tony Scott film, Spy Game,
which I have heard. It feels like, just from the title and poster, that we should have talked about it 7-8 episodes ago.
An anomaly.
Yeah.
With co-starring, do you know?
Richard Gere?
Bobby Redford. Robert Redford.
Yeah, why not?
They're kind of similar.
Yeah, I guess I could feel like I could just vaguely remember the silhouette on the poster, and I thought maybe it was Gere, but...
We will be joined by friend of the podcast... Sam Tyford Moore.
Exciting.
Very exciting. He's a writer and author. He has a really, really good book called The Rapids. And he writes a lot about film and thinks a lot about film. So we'll have him here to bully Dan, which is my favorite. And then the week after that, we can just announce it all. Week after that, we'll do Ocean's 11 with special guest Alex Gallagher.
Exciting.
Amazing journalist and poet and friend of me.
Yeah.
What more could you want right here on the Brad Pitt cast?
Qualified.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we should have a guest for the one after that. Let's just keep it going.
What is
Confessions Sinbad? Of a Dangerous Mind.
Good. Yeah,
no one wants to talk Sinbad. I've asked multiple people.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe we get Xavier back.
That's not a bad idea.
Shall we? Would that be funny?
Well, it depends. We've got to ask Xavier.
I do it in person.
Okay. Yeah.
With Xavier.
Well, wait. We've got to find out who wants to.
Rate and review this podcast.
Yes, please.
Subscribe on Spotify if you're able to do that. Tell your friends.
Yeah.
Email thebradpittcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
You look like you have
something. We got a review on the American iTunes store.
Did we?
Which I noticed, which is exciting. Because so the American say? One, we'll look and find out.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's a nice one.
Is it?
Yeah. Good. I think I know who it was as well.
Do you?
Yeah. Because we have obviously not as many American fans as we do Australian, but we're trying to break into the market.
Yeah, the American market. Thank you so much for listening.
As always.
If you leave a review, we'll choose the best review and you get to pick Dan to watch Solo. I should probably give the proper blurb. If you give a review...
At some point in the near future, we will be looking at the reviews we have gotten, picking one that we like, and that person can pick a non-Brad Pitt film that we will watch.
And Dan said, don't choose Solo.
And so Joe wants us to watch Solo. But I would prefer... It wouldn't be funny.
The episode on Solo would just be like, this film is really unpleasant. I'm aware, but I have to have the joke.
I understand.
That's what I'm about.
All right.
We got to go to a bookstore.
Yeah, see you next time. Love you
all. See you next time. Love you.
Bye.